Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 209 of Her, the podcast where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, why it's okay to suck at everything. Well, maybe not everything, a few things. So, we have a terrific show, and I can't even wait. But before we begin, just know that this episode is made possible by, yes, our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. So hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com and scope it out. All right, so here's your first official reminder to click on iTunes after this episode, because, honey, I want to hear you. Rate and review this show. You are going to love it. And I will sit here and I will wait for your feedback because I know it's going to be rip-roaring robust. Oh my gosh, I'm alliterating. It's okay. I do this when I get excited. All right, everybody. It's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
So, I mean, seriously, who wouldn't want to pick up a book that says, for the title, it's great to suck at something? Say what? Yeah, that's what I just said. It's great to suck at something. Huh. All right, we got it. It's provocative. Well, so also is the author, my wonderful friend, Karen Rinaldi, who is the publisher of Harper Wave, an imprint she founded in 2012, and is senior vice president at HarperCollins Publishers. She's worked in the publishing industry for over two decades, or does it just feel that way, as a publisher, editor, and content creator. She wrote the story for Maggie's Plan, the 2015 film inspired by Karen's novel, The End of Men. Her nonfiction work has appeared in the New York Times, Oprah.com, Time, you get it. And she's ridiculously cool. Karen, welcome to the Her Podcast.
Wow, that was quite a preamble. Thank you, Pam. It's so good to talk to you, as always.
Yeah. So here we are with this ridiculously cool book. It just, what inspired you to write this in the first place? I remember when you wrote the op-ed in the New York Times. I think it was in 2017. Yes, yeah, it was. I see it here before my little eyes. And you were talking about, well, it was interesting. You said surfing became a kind of obsession for you. And yet, and I quote, I suck at it. And it's the sport of Hawaiian kings, but you're a jester. And then you said, once I actually cried tears of joy over what any observer would have thought, well, a so-so performance on a so-so wave. Yes, I was moved to tears by mediocrity. So why continue? Why pursue something I'll never be good at? Because it's great to suck at something. So tell me, why did you go to this place?
Well, I started surfing really late in life, and I wouldn't recommend it to anyone to start at 40, except if you're going to be okay with and preparing to suck at it. And that could be true of any new endeavor, right? So I started at 40 on a lark, but also something I'd always wanted to surf, but I was too afraid to try. Something happened after I had children. I don't know. Some kind of fear was released, and in its place, new fears came. And I thought, I'm gonna try it. I have to try it just once, and then I can move on. But it occupied my dreams and my nightmares, truthfully. So I went out there. I tried it once, and I was hooked. And then I was hooked, but it was hard. It was harder than it seemed. And then it took me another 5 years of trying to actually catch and ride a wave for real. I mean, not in the white water, you know, getting pushed, you know, to the shore kind of way, but, you know, dropping into a wave and riding its face. And I've been doing it now for about 18 years, and I still suck at it. And what astounds me is that it's still the thing I love to do the most. So I wrote the book because I kept asking myself, how is it possible that the thing I'm worst at in my life is the thing that brings me the most joy? And I started writing about it, just puzzling it out. And I came up with some pretty deep answers, and I learned a lot about myself in the meantime.
What'd you learn?
Well, I learned that we are so driven by our goal-driven lives that everything has some weighty relevance. Everything we do, we think this is going to be who I am, and I have to try to be as close to perfect as possible. And what if I fail? Oh no, I have my job. I have to kill it at my job. I have to be, you know, a great partner, a great parent. These are all things that where the expectations for us to succeed make sense, right? Like we have to be good at that stuff. I think when I surfed, it didn't matter if I sucked at surfing. Nobody needed me to surf well. And there was so much relief in that, just that part of the equation. And then I realized as I paddled out, I got to focus on the one thing I was doing where I didn't have to be good at it. I could forgive myself for being, you know, less than perfect, by the way, not perfect at anything. I don't know any of us who are, but we still strive for perfection. And I think that's a huge amount of pressure. So I started doing this thing where I didn't need to be good. I could just be in the moment. I could forgive myself for kooking out, for falling, for wiping out. I mean, the metaphors are rife in surfing, but I found that I mean, this is going to sound a little hokey, but I found a lot of self-love in the effort alone and not in the success. And every once in a while, I catch a wave, I ride it, like, you know, in a mediocre way. But, you know, I get jazzed from it, and I love that feeling. But the whole process just brings me joy. And I think part of it is that it brings me a kind of freedom that I don't feel in the rest of my life. And then what I realized is that practicing that freedom and feeling that freedom, I could then apply to other parts of my life. It didn't make me better at doing the important things, but it made me forgive myself for when I screwed up, because, you know, we all screw up even when the stakes are high, you know, we can mess up. And I think we have to learn that we're human and that that's okay.
I love it. You had a beautiful review in the Washington Post. I was reading some of these reviews, and there was this one piece in it where, you know, you really hang out at parties and with, you know, groups and whatever, and everyone's kind of comparing, like, oh my gosh, I was so excellent in that 5K and I killed it. I crushed it and I did this and I did this. But it's like there's this whole push to have to say that to the world. Look how damn good I am at this. And they said in this article, we live in an era of aspirational psychosis, working longer and harder than our neighbors in pursuit of a calculated end goal so we can stand there and say, look at us, one way or the other. And you just went the opposite direction. You said, wait a minute,
exactly.
No. You're missing the point. Can you kind of go to that aspirational psychosis place and help us understand that?
Yeah, so I base that on this idea that, listen, social media is all about it, but also, you know, it's an old trope, right? Because we've been seeing it in advertising for decades and decades and decades, where you kind of look at, I have to be thinner and more athletic and more beautiful and smarter and richer and healthier. I mean, sometimes, you know, healthy outcomes can almost become, you know, a burden. I think sometimes if we listen to our bodies know how to be healthy, right? And we don't listen anymore because we're aspiring to fix everything and we want to control everything. And actually in that exchange, that aspiration that I can be, you know, better, faster, stronger, prettier, blah, 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 you know, all those things, you know, look younger, we we don't, it doesn't, our lives, we look at our lives and it doesn't stack up, right? We kind of go, oh man, I'm missing the boat. But my neighbor, my Facebook friend, my Instagram, you know, connection, like they're all getting it. They're going on better vacations. Their sunsets are prettier, you know, their flowers, their gardens are lusher. And so we know better. We know this is not true. And yet we still fall prey to it. And so I'm saying stop looking kind of outward in that way and look inward, A, that's one thing. And then B, instead of embracing only the ways in which you succeed, celebrate the effort, no matter the outcome, no matter the outcome. So if it's something, I'm going to go, sing a karaoke and my voice is going to be off key and I'm going to celebrate that, or I'm going to knit this sweater and it's going to be a little bit crooked, and like celebrate those imperfections, right? And I think what happens when we do that, we become kinder to ourselves. And the best part, not the best part, but a really good kind of knock-on effect to this is that we get more patient and nicer to other people around us, because what it says at the end is, I suck at this, but I'm still worthy of love. You suck at that, and you are still, I still love you. I love you not only in spite of it, but I love you because of it, because you have the guts to do it anyway. And that's one of the things I found paddling out to the lineup and being very self-conscious at first and being so bad at it, that people were so kind and people were helping. I was so bad at it that I frustrated other people. Not because because they would look at me and think, oh my God, she needs so much help. And they would wonder why I did it. And then they saw the joy I was having, and then they would come in and they would help me. So it invited kindness. So good things come out of this acceptance of ourselves as being people who are not afraid to suck at something, to do something for just the sheer joy, and not the goal, not the reward, not the gold star, not the trophy, not the, somebody saying, yeah, look at me, and like, oh, look at you, I wish I could be you. You know, when somebody saw a video of me surfing and they thought I was really cool because I surfed, I finally posted a video of me really being bad at it, and she walked into my office and she said, wow, you really do suck at surfing. I said, yes, I do. You thought it was a humble brag and that I was actually killing it out there, and I'm not. And I said, how does that make you feel? And she said, it kind of makes me feel good. And I said, I know, and I'm okay with that. She wasn't being unkind. She just had this idea that she didn't stack up to what she perceived as my coolness. And as soon as I said, I am really not cool, I'm not good at this, she said, thank you. And I thought, job done. Like, that's the point. That's sort of what I'm trying to get at.
Well, as you were talking, I was thinking about something, because I also saw your beautiful piece in the Wall Street Journal very recently, as your book was launched, talking about the new rules of middle age. I want to go to the age place for an interesting reason. There's a whole science to play that a lot of people don't know about. There are scientists actually out there. I mean, there are even journals called Play, the Science of Play. Now,
right.
I go to the age place for a reason. If you look at children, young children, as they fall off their tricycle and, the ball, hit them in the head and whatever else, what do? They think it's funny. They just, fall down
exactly.
And go, okay, that was a trip, and then they're joyful. They're like, oh my gosh, it's almost like, hey, let's do that again. That was kind of cool. There were no goals. There were no objectives. No one's trying to, count the number of calories you're burning out there. And no one's looking at your bicep. They're just playing. They're joyfully playing. That's what they're doing. Okay. Then
exactly.
From somewhere, as we hit the double digits, 10 years old and whatever, we start listening to the voices of culture. And then suddenly, as you said in your book, sucking at anything gets a bad rap, right? It's like,
right.
No, you don't want to suck at something. You have to be the best. Overachieve. All right. So then we spend from about age 10 to about age 60. Screwing this up badly, where we're in this aspirational psychosis. But look at you now. You are 57. And so could it be that what we're really doing is coming full circle, and we're coming back to the almost joyful, playful place and letting it rip in a way that we couldn't do
that.
when we were What do you think?
Oh, I love that. I mean, that's a beautiful image that we do come full circle. I'd like to think that we can be present in that circle the entire way around, right? And that's part of what the book is supposed is means to do, which is to say, as soon as that moment of self-consciousness kicks in, and I don't know what age, I'm sure there are studies in this, but, you know, when they kick in for kids, it probably depends on their environment. But, you know, as soon as that self-consciousness kicks in and you get that self, that voice in your head that is the critic, right? And that lives and lives and lives. And if we could, learn to make, you know, make friends with, or, you know, even frenemies with that critic in our head, and push it aside and say, you know, who are you? What are you telling me? You know, my effort is good. And by the way, I am going to be good at some things and I'm going to be less good at other things. That is perfectly okay. But this idea that you grow up, right, and then you learn to let go of some of those fears of what people are going to say about you. And I do think that there's, and I don't know if there are studies on this, but I do think there are probably, you know, there's probably some truth in that, is that you start to say, this is who I am, take it or leave it. Like, I'm done trying to, like, you know, conform to somebody else's set of expectations. But I do think that there is, so talking on the other side of it, people from middle age on, I do think there's a voice in their heads as well that says, oh, I can't do that because, I hear this all the time, I can't do that because I'm too old. Oh, I, you know, wish I could get a tattoo. I hear this all the time. Wish I'd get a tattoo, but oh, I'm too old to get a tattoo. One of my favorite stories from a tattoo artist was this woman who was 88 years old, I think, coming into a shop for her first tattoo. And the artist asked her, why now? why at 88? And she said, well, my husband hated tattoos, and now he's dead, so I could finally get a tattoo.
Oh, my God.
It's the craziest story. This is a true story. This actually was a true story. This woman, okay, the point was that she didn't give up on it, though. At 88, she walked into a tattoo parlor and got her first tattoo. That was, like, one of the most joyous stories I've ever heard, and it's not really connected to sucking at something, but it's connected to this idea that we're never too old. Listen, I said, you know, I started surfing at 40 and you should never do that, and then actually that's not true. You should try. I know people who tried surfing for the first time at 60 and didn't do too badly. Really? Like, you think, what is the voice that says you can't have that, and then get rid of that voice, because that voice is a liar. Right? That voice just wants to deny you of experience and joy, you know? And so I think we do that idea of play. I like to think that we kind of shake off that self-consciousness and we can just play. Dancing is a big thing, right? I think dancing, so because we dance our whole lives, but I do think that people get very self-conscious about dancing. You know, the people who stay on the sidelines and say, oh, I'm going to sit this one out, or I'm not going to dance, because we're so self-conscious. And then dance is something naturally we all just want to go lay. Who doesn't want to just go leave it on the dance floor, right? But it's hard. It's hard. Sometimes I get self-conscious and then I don't go dance, and I love it. And I think it's just all of these things are just that critic in our head gets there. But I think as we get older, both things happen. I think we loosen up a little bit because we don't care as much. We don't care that what people think of us as much because we know it doesn't matter. But I also think we tell ourselves a story that we're too old for X, Y, and Z. You don't fall, Pam, I know you. You don't fall into this trap at all, right? Is there anything you would say that you couldn't do?
No. I remember George Bernard Shaw, let's bring him on. We don't stop playing because we grow old. We grow old because we stop playing.
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay, I'm all about the play thing. I'm sorry, that's kind of
good.
Where I come from.
I love this. No, I think that play is a huge part, and that's a huge part of what the book is. There's even a section where I go into the research on play, and basically people have even studied that play is what makes us human, right?
Precisely.
Mostly people don't play. Animals, when they quote-unquote play, are really training for the kill, for the hunt. They're training for something, right? When we play, when we truly are in a place of play, it's for no goal. And that's what I mean about sucking at something. There is no goal. When I surf, there is no reason in the world for me to surf except for the fact of doing it. And the freedom of doing that, remembering that, yeah, I go and spend a couple hours in the ocean and nothing comes of it except that experience and my joy and you know, I share it with friends and community sometimes if I'm not surfing alone, but, you know, there's not a goal there. So that's what makes us human. So what happens if we stop playing? Does that make us less human? Maybe. You know what I mean? You got to think
about
that.
I really think that. Yeah. You know, it's interesting in that, you know, book that's been around since dinosaurs ruled the earth, The Four Agreements by Ruiz. You know, you were using his language. I'm sure that, you know, you've read it 900 times too. And that is people and children especially become domesticated. That's the word he uses. They become domesticated.
Yeah, no, I haven't read it, but I'm going to read it.
Oh, my God. It's like ridiculous.
Yeah.
The Four
Agreements.
I'm writing
it down. I'm going to read it.
Okay, The Four Agreements by Ruiz. And, you know, he is a Toltec Mexican physician and philosopher. Comes from a long line of these sort of medicine people. And he's actually a fully trained physician in the traditional sense. And he wrote this book, which really basically just said, I can't believe you're using the same words, Karen. It kind of, it's amazing. Because he said, what you start learning are lies. Stop playing. Sit down. Cross your legs. You know, be quiet.
Right.
Don't smile. You know, we could keep doing this forever. See, here's the good news. You know, I went to Berkeley, so that should explain the rest of it. And we don't listen to anybody, so none of that resonated, Karen. You know, it's like, okay, thanks for sharing. You know, I'm going to do my little thing.
Yeah, I'm going to go and find my own path. Yep.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about it because I think people have taken this in interesting places. I think part of the reason why people in middle age, you know, if you look at the rules of middle age and all the rest of it, start being able to, you know, open up and be much more rebellious and say, you know, to hell with it. This is who I am. You don't like it. There's the exit door. Okay. Is that you also have achieved in your life.
Yes.
And you feel fairly satisfied with a lot of those achievements. And then it's like, what am I, you know, trying to do here? Am I, you know, who am I trying to impress? I mean, you know, let's get over ourselves here. Let's have some fun. Let's be creative. Let's fall down. Let's do wild and crazy things. Let's just do that. And interestingly, a lot of research on new companies created after the age of 50 were by women, a huge majority of women, who just went out there and just kicked ass and said, to hell with it. And they became more fearless. There's like a fearlessness. So when you're looking at the wave, you're like, okay, wave, here I come. This may not be pretty, but here I come. And you're just you're just letting it do it. I'm thinking about something, Karen. When I ran my first marathon, it was the Marine Corps Marathon. I had never run a marathon in my life. I really hate running long distance. I'm actually built as a sprinter. I'm very muscular. I'm a triathlete. So I have no business doing anything like a marathon.
I thought it'd be kind of cool.
I don't know. Everybody's doing it. There's like this cool medal and, you know, some Marines along the way. I mean, yeah, it's nice looking and whatever. So I show up. I'm completely absolutely clueless. And, you know, I'd done some training and this and that, but I don't like get crazy about it. I was there to have fun, right? So I stand there in my little corral, you know, they have these waves, and these guys walk up to me, and, you know, they're like ridiculously shredded runners, you know, and they're staring at their watches. And I said, like, what's up? What are you okay? You keep staring at your watch. And they said, well, what time are you going to make it? What's your goal? And I said, and then they gave me their numbers. They said, well, I'm going to make it in 3 hours and 10 minutes. And I said, wow. So then they looked at me again. What's your goal? And I thought about it and I said, to finish.
That's so good. Absolutely. Perfect.
And guess,
perfect answer.
You know, Does that make sense? So it was like I just didn't get swallowed up in the craziness. I had a blast. I was out there. I had my friends show up at every 5 miles, and they had this big sign saying, "Remember, you paid to do this to yourself." they made me laugh. And one of the last signs was, "All you're going to get is a medal and a T-shirt. Good luck." And, you know, and it went on and on. And I'm having a good time out there. And these people are all obsessively trying to go as fast as they could.
Right.
And I'm just thinking, wow, they're missing the point. I'm really having a good time. So when I read the book, which I just think is amazing, this is exactly what you're saying. Just go out there and, I mean, aren't you really advocating for being fearless?
Yes. Or letting go of the fear of failure, which I think is what a lot of fear is based in, right? A lot of fear, I think, is if you go down, you examine it, it's based in your fear of failure. And then you say, well, what does that mean, right? Well, it's like, well, if I fail, then I'll be humiliated, because we're terrified of being humiliated. What I like to do is look at the etymology of the word humiliation, because it's the same basis as humility, right? And it comes from the word humus, which is ground, right? So being grounded or being in the dirt, right? Depends on how you want to interpret it. So I feel like your fear of failure is a fear of humiliation, whether anybody witnesses you or just to yourself even, right? And you can turn that failure, which I do all the time when I surf, I mean, I constantly fail, into a kind of humility. And humility basically helps you open up to everything. It opens up to yourself. You open up to other people. So this idea where you turned your you were being humble, right? You were showing humility and saying, I'd like to finish. You know, I don't need to beat your butt in this race. That's not the point of it. I won't be humiliated by having people pass me by. I'm just going to show humility and grace in the kind of acceptance and also the beauty and the fact that I'm even here at the starting line and I'm going to try to finish. What happens if you didn't finish? Maybe you didn't have to finish. You could have not finished. And what would that say about you? It wouldn't say that you weren't worthy or not lovable. It would just mean you tried, you couldn't finish. Maybe you'll try again. Or maybe you go, oh man, I'm a sprinter. I'm not a long distance person. What am I doing here? And that's okay too. It's all okay. It's our attachment to it. It's our attachment to the outcome that sends us off, I think, into the negative zone, as opposed to letting go of our attachment to outcome. And then it's just about what? And it's just about being and doing and the experience. And that's fun. That's just fun. And that can be brought to everything, you know, all of your tasks, even the tasks you don't want to do. You know, you have those days where you go, oh man, I have to do this today. I don't want to do it. And then if you say, okay, I'm going to release myself from that value judgment, and I'm just going to be in the moment. Usually the thing in front of you is not so daunting or challenging, or it might be challenging, but it won't be so daunting, and you won't resist it, right? You won't keep fighting it. So I feel like the application of it is rich in all aspects of our lives.
You're also saying that perfection, the trying to seek perfection, leads to paralysis, and you can't even take that first step to get forward. You know, seriously.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very interesting. A while back, believe it or not, this can only happen to me, but you know me, Karen. It's like I can't even make this stuff up. So it was a day after the Monica Lewinsky thing on television where she, you know, was interviewed by Barbara Walters. And the day after, I was actually in the White House with all, you know, the top female athletes. Because we were going to be reviewing for the first time Billie Jean King's wonderful documentary about women in sports. And Hillary Clinton was going to be our host. And yes, he did show up. That was quite interesting all the way around.
Wow.
Yeah, I was there because I was doing a lot of work.
That's an amazing moment.
Oh, yeah, well, that was sort of me. So I'm sitting there, you know, in the audience, and I'm surrounded by Chrissy Evert and all these people, and my jaws hitting the floor, and the only person taller than me there was Gabby Reese. And who was sitting next to me was Nadia Comaneci. And as everyone knows, she obviously was the 14-year-old in the Olympics a long time ago who garnered perfect scores in gymnastics. I mean, perfects. Okay, there you have the perfect thing. So I couldn't help myself. I looked at her and I introduced myself. I said, needless to say, I'm a huge fan, and et cetera, et cetera. I said, so I decided to mess with her. I said, so what's it like to be perfect? And of course she, you know, she's laughing her ass off because she's only been asked this, I don't know, a million times. And she always has the same answer. And she goes, let me be very clear. Okay. I am not perfect. I am a living being. My scores were perfect.
Right.
I am not perfect. Let's be really clear.
That's so good.
So those are metrics, so analytics, you know, things that you can make up and, you know, but I am not perfect. She says, I strive to be the best I can be. And then she smiled and she says, how do you like that for a canned reply?
No, she said, that's so good.
Yes.
Somebody will publish this and say, make sure you come across as likable, and here's what you say to be likable.
I'm sure that's true.
I'm sure she is not perfect. She got a perfect score. That does not mean that she's perfect in everything. Listen, perfection is a, you just said the word, I think you said striving. Perfection is a striving. And there are studies actually on this as well. And there's the striving for perfection, or, you know, our normal striving for perfection, and then there is abnormal striving for perfection. And the abnormal striving for perfection says anything less than perfect means I have failed. Anything less than a gold medal. Like, you know that you know the tendency now to say, oh, he got a silver. She got the silver or the bronze, not the gold. You're going, yeah? Okay.
Yeah, what are you, nuts or something?
I mean?
that means they're second in the world.
Yeah, or for that moment, only for that moment, because it's really by a microsecond, right? That's whatever effort was made. But I think this idea of normal striving for perfection means we want to improve. Listen, here's the thing. I've been surfing for 18 years. I am better at it than I was 10 years ago. I can surf a bigger wave. I can surf better. I still suck at it. So it's not that I'm not getting better, but I'm very honest about my ability, my capability, and I have to do that so I don't put myself in dangerous situations and all of the rest. But if I had an abnormal striving for perfection and I couldn't go out there unless I caught the perfect wave, first of all, that doesn't exist, but, you know, no, that's not true. It does exist. And surfers can probably scan their brains for the perfect waves that they have seen people surf. I mean, I can name a couple of them. Not me, but people, the best of the best in the perfect conditions, blah, blah, blah. And they're so rare and they're so fleeting and momentary that, you know, you kind of are in awe of them. But, you know, that so abnormal striving for perfection leads to what? Right? Depression, anxiety, mental health problems. It really does. And there is a direct connection to that. Normal striving for perfection, there's a lot of hope, there's the hard work, and there's the striving, but you're never, you know, we're not going to get to perfect. You know, I always say, you know, I've asked groups of people, it's like, how many of you have called yourselves at one point or another, or used the phrase, I am such a perfectionist that, dot, 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 dot. And in that phrase, I'm such a perfectionist that, are all of the excuses of why we don't do something. Oh, I could never do that. I'm such a perfectionist. Oh, I couldn't do that. And you think about all of the joy and all the experiences that we're not having because we're quote unquote perfectionists. And then you ask the question, how many of you do anything perfectly? And not one hand will go up in an audience. Because, I mean, we're good. We're good at stuff. Nadia Comaneci had a couple of routines that were perfect. All of her routines, every time she performs, they are not perfect. That came together at that moment. She was in a state of flow. It all happened. She had the judges who saw the same thing, you know. But, you know, how many of us, you know, do things perfectly? Every once in a while, we hit that moment and it's awesome. But the rest of it is striving. And if we get comfortable with that striving and not judgmental about ourselves or others, by the way, because that's just a huge piece of this, you know, we're going to be happier. We're going to be more open-hearted. We'll have more compassion, self-compassion, and compassion for others. So all good things come out of this. So that's really what the suck at something ethos is really kind of an invitation to give ourselves a break in a way, and to give ourselves a break to play, as you were talking about, and that's a huge part of it.
And that's why I'm so glad you brought it up in the book. And, you know, right now I'm just saying to all the HER listeners out there, suck without shame. Let's reclaim sucking. Try new things. You know, I was when in your book, you noted that you dabbled in many sports. And I mean, good Lord, it's boxing, cycling, weightlifting, running, skiing, horseback riding. I'm getting exhausted. And you said you probably suck at all of them, but you know, it was cool. It was a great experience. I mean, seriously, it's a life without regret. You know,
absolutely.
You did all that.
Yeah, even for the tough stuff. Even for the tough stuff. Listen, I almost, you know, died horseback riding because, you know, I made some, there's a story in the book about it, which is very funny, but it's funny only because I survived it. But, you know, you kind of go, stuff is hard. Things are really hard. They're so much harder than they seem. And I find joy in that. I find beauty in the fact that things are so much harder than they seem. I don't find that as being an obstacle. I find that as an invitation. And by the way, when you see people doing something really well, you look at them and go, oh man, look at that person, you know, riding that horse, which looks so easy until you get on the back of a horse and you realize, oh, I don't know what I'm doing here, and you know, I'm in trouble. Or, you know, surfing, you know, for example, or any of it, running a marathon. Yeah, I can run a marathon. I can do that, or I can sprint, you know, 100-yard dash. But it's all harder than it seems. And I think there's beauty in that. And that's the exciting part of it.
It's the adventure.
Yes,
that's the word. That's the word I love more than anything else. And then finally, pivoting back to the age thing again, you know, because this was in you know, most of your reviews, this was really hammered home in the Wall Street Journal piece, which I thought was fabulous, and a great picture of you in your little wetsuit waving at the world. there you were. So this whole issue, when does it end? So first of all, we have, you know, the little party poopers, you know, who say that, you know, I'm too old for this. Well, I read the George Bernard Shaw quote, so we just killed that. So that's not going to happen. But what if this issue of, here comes the word, retirement? Are you ever going to, like, as it were, retire?
No, never. I will start something new perhaps one day, but I will never. I can't. You know, I think of you as being this way too, but I feel like I'm a little, if you're going to put a pejorative on it, I'm greedy for life. There's so much good stuff to do, right? So, you know, retiring, you know, I think when people say retiring, I think they mean they're not going to do the thing that they've done for their whole lives. And I'd like to think they're going to move on to doing something else that has captured their attention and their hearts and do that. But to like retire and have nothing to do all day or not to give back. If anything, I think, retiring, like when I don't have to, you know, when making, you know, supporting my family is no longer as imperative as it is right now, you know, there are so many things that you can go and give back to the world, right? There are things you can do. So I think you stay as active. I think your mind and your body stays as healthy and active as you keep it. And as soon as you turn that off, it all goes to you know where. It goes to hell. Let you say it. But
yeah,
you got to keep.
I know.
You
it's know, my show.
Use it,
what the
right?
hell?
What do they say? Use it or lose it. Right. But I also think that there's so much. There's so much experience in the world to be had, and I don't know why anybody would walk away from that. And I do think the more you do, the more you want to do, right?
You know, it's interesting. In July, we're going to be having the Senior Olympics in Albuquerque. It's every 2 years. I'm on their board, and I'm also a Senior Olympic triathlete. And I have never had more fun in my life than watching people age 50 and over. That's the definition of a senior Olympian. You have to be at least 50. If you're 49, honey, you don't qualify. But you have to be 50.
I love it.
Right? And the thing about this is it's 50 plus because, God, we don't even know where it ends. We have a 102-year-old 50-meter sprinter. We've got – I mean, just it goes on forever.
Oh,
so many.
Good. That's so amazing.
Seriously.
So awesome.
Well, these people beautiful. Are cool. You know, you have but the reason why I bring this up is they're a beautiful testimony to the whole issue of once you hit a certain age, you just kick ass. You just go out there and you you know, I've raised the family, I've done the work, whatever, my turn. Yeah. You know, get out of my way.
Yeah.
And I don't care what I look like out there. I'm just going to have some fun. And here's the joke. Seriously, we have a little joke among the Senior Olympics. And that is, if you could just stay healthy enough to outlive the competition, then if you show up and there's if you show up and there's only three of you, you could fight over which one's going to get one of them. But you're going to walk out of there with a medal.
That is so good.
Oh, my God. It's so much fun.
Yeah, that's hilarious. Oh, that is so good. You just have to outlive the competition.
I just outlive
them. My thing is like, no, I look at people. I get worried because I think, oh, I'm 57. And I want to keep surfing. I want to surf for the rest of my life. And I am in touch now, because of the community that I'm in, I wind up being in touch with people of all different ages, surfers of all ages. And, there are women and men out there surfing in their 70s, at 80. And I think, I'm going the distance with this. I am going to try to paddle out until I'm gone, maybe it'll be the last paddle out and that'll be it. I'll just go, I'll disappear, and that'll be fine with me. My idea is just you want to keep, keep doing it. And not for any reason except because it brings me joy. And it might get hard. Maybe I'll have to paddle out on a boogie board. Maybe I'll just have to paddle out on a board and just lie there and not paddle into and catch a wave. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what form it takes. It's just, it doesn't have to be pretty. It doesn't have to be accomplished. You just got to keep doing it. And there's a beauty in that. Very quickly, if we have 2 minutes of time, in the middle of my surfing, life, I was diagnosed with cancer. And I don't know if this is too much for the show, but I got breast cancer and I was very sick in treatment for a year and surgeries. And it was just one thing after the other. Everything went wrong. And at the end of that year where my butt was kicked all over the place, after I realized, I asked, am I going to die? And then the answer was, no, not right now from this. And then the second was, am I going to be able to surf again? Not, am I going to be able to get back to the office? I mean, I worked the whole time, so it didn't matter. But, my idea was I wanted to go surf again. That was the biggest impetus to get strong as quickly as I could. It's because I wanted to paddle back out.
How cool is that?
Oh. Well, you said the thing I'm least good at, the thing I suck at, is the biggest reason to live, besides my family, of course, and friends. I mean, family, love, friends, that's first, and that doesn't, that shouldn't need to be said. But the reason to live was that, damn it, I'm going to paddle out and I'm going to surf again. And 4 weeks after my last round of chemo, where I was dead on the couch, I mean, I could not move. I really was lying there saying, this is what it feels like to die, because I'd been through 2 rounds of protocols, 5 different surgeries. It just was not a good year. And I thought, I'm going to surf in 4 weeks. I mean, I was a mess. But you know what? My son was like, no, Mama, I don't think you should paddle out. And I'm like, I'm just going to get in the water with my board. And you know what? I crawled up on my knees onto my feet and I took this little tiny wave in. And that was it. I was exhausted, but I did it. And I remember thinking, this is a reason to live. Sucking at something is a reason to live. And that sort of solidified it for me. And I thought, there's something in this.
I'm just blown away. I wish I could talk forever and I probably could, but that's a threat, not a promise. So I know that our listeners out there on the Her Podcast land have just been sitting here going, first of all, you're so real, Karen, with all of your accomplishments, the amazing work that you've done. You're just real. You're down to earth. You're a woman who is, I hate that word, middle age, but a woman in her 50s.
That's all right. I don't mind.
Right? A woman in her 50s who's just calling it what it is and
absolutely
redefining and reframing all of this in a realistic, fun, fearless way. And quite frankly, showing the world that it's perfectly fine to suck at as much as you want. And
absolutely.
Obviously,
yeah,
you're
it's beautiful. It's even not only is it fine, it's awesome.
it's a boatload of fun.
Yeah.
I can't even thank you enough. So stay put. We're going to go ahead and wrap this little Hummer up, and then I'm going to come right back to you. So, You know,
I'll be right
everyone
here.
Out there.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Listen, you heard Karen Rinaldi, who is the author of It's Great to Suck at Something. And this book is an absolute must. We're going to reframe the entire dialogue around this. Stop all of this aspirational psychosis and you got to be perfect and the best at everything. Just bag it and sidebar it. Instead, just embrace the fact that you're going to have a hodgepodge of everything. Going to be good at certain things, not so much on other things. Have fun anyway, and for God's sake, never stop playing. You heard that. Run on over to Karen's website, K Rinaldi, that's RINALDI.com, and have a convo with her. You know, look at all of her work, and for God's sake, just get the damn book, because all I can say is it's a game changer. Oh, so everyone out there, take a moment right now. I'm watching you, kind of, sort of, and run on over to iTunes, rate and review the show because this show was that good. And I'm sitting here waiting to hear from you because I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and I'm host of the Her Podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every single episode of the Her Podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Now, thanks for listening today, and do whatever it takes to stay well.